Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, The Guardian's weekly exploration of all things Brexity. This week, yes, it's a year to go till Brexit Day. Well, a bit less than a year now, to be precise, but by this time next year, Britain will have left the European Union. Although, to be fair, it probably won't feel like it, because if all goes according to plan, we will immediately enter a 2-year standstill or status quo transition period, during which everything will be pretty much exactly the same as it is now. But still, March the 29th, 2019 is a significant date. The UK, if you believe the Brexiters, will have taken back control of its borders, its laws and its money, in principle, if not yet in practice. While for the EU, a member state will have left the bloc for the very first time in its history. So, this was what you might call a pre-anniversary, if that's a word. And as the media likes to do with all anniversaries, there was a veritable slew of programmes and articles and columns last week to mark the occasion. None of them left us any the wiser, of course, about what Brexit will actually look like when it finally happens. That's still as clear as mud. And an awful lot could happen over the coming 12 months to change what Brexit means Brexit, to coin a phrase, actually means. Anyway, with me today to chew over what's happened so far and to take a few educated guesses about what might be coming next are Brexit Means regular pundits, The Guardian's Brexit policy editor Dan Roberts and Brussels correspondent Jennifer Rankin. Welcome to both of you.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hi. Jennifer, let's start with where things stand right now from the EU's perspective with a year to go, shall we? I guess it's fair to say that the script has pretty much followed the 27's playbook so far, hasn't it? Article 50 divorce talks before the trade negotiations, no cherry picking of the four freedoms, a status quo, time limited transition period, all that kind of thing has come to pass. So looking back over, from where we are now, has the EU in fact given ground on anything at all, do you think?
Well, in a word, no. Not on the big thing, certainly, that you mentioned, the sequencing of the talks, the insistence on maintaining the EU rulebook. But I think it wasn't inevitable that it went that way. And if we rewind back to the morning after the referendum, that June morning when everyone was waking up to learn the result that Britain had voted for Brexit, I don't think anyone could have predicted that it would have gone exactly this way for the EU. And I think from the EU's point of view, it's gone better than anyone would have dared hope for. Because the fact is the EU has managed to remain united so far. And partly because maintaining unity has been relatively easy because everyone can agree on the fact that the UK ought to settle its divorce bill and ought to safeguard the rights of EU citizens in the UK after Brexit. So far, it's been relatively easy for the EU to unite. And I think the EU has played its much stronger hand rather well. And you can see that the UK has again and again had to accept things that it insisted it wouldn't accept. It's had to accept the EU sequencing, and it's had to sign up to the EU's version of a time-limited transition where it has no say in any of the rules. So yes, on the big things, the EU hasn't given ground at all. Yes, we can see areas here and there where there have been small concessions, but by and large, we should really see this as a very atypical negotiation, in a sense not really a negotiation at all. I'm reminded of some words by Pascal Lamy, a former French European Commissioner, who described Brexit as an adjustment rather than a negotiation. And I think that's very much the pattern we've seen so far. But when we get into the next stage, into the trade talks, things might start to change.
Right.
But that's still in the road
to
ahead.
Come. Yes, I mean, I guess it's a reflection of, in a way, really, of the fact, of the simple fact and kind of unavoidable fact, which maybe wasn't particularly appreciated in Britain, that, you know, that, I mean, the EU is basically an immensely sort of complex assemblage of legal constructs that's been put together gradually over the sort of a half a century or so. And there simply isn't that much room for flexibility or manoeuvre or compromise or anything like that in there.
Yes, and once you start sort of carving out exemptions for a country that isn't in the union, then what does that mean for those that are? How can the remaining countries come to an agreement on corporate taxes or welfare standards for animals if they've already given some special magical deal to a country outside the bloc? It doesn't make any political sense at all. So that's why I think it's that sort of realization that the EU is a bloc that has its own interests. It's also helped to really cement unity. And then there's something about the Brexit process where the EU's really discovered what it's all about. And it's really been quite an educational process. And you actually hear some of the diplomats involved saying this as well, that it sort of forced the EU members to look at what being a part of this club really means.
That's right. I remember, yes, you did a piece, didn't you, last week? And you quoted somebody saying, you know, that after regular get-togethers, people say to each other, yeah, well, it does look quite cold outside.
Yes, that came from talking to one of the people involved in the sort of EU 27 working group meetings. And I think that is half the point, really, that it should be better from an EU point of view to be inside the club than to be outside. So these negotiations really a reminder of that fact. It's also a point that Michel Barnier likes to make quite frequently. He describes sort of Brexit as a lesson, as an educational process. This always goes down quite badly in the British media because it's sort of interpreted as we're going to teach you a lesson. But I think it's not quite what he means. But he's really trying to suggest that Brexit is educational for the EU as well.
For everybody involved. Yes, exactly. Well, I think we can say, Dan, can't we, that it has been quite pretty educational for the British side, at least so far. I mean, it's quite hard to avoid the impression, isn't it, that Britain has basically rolled over on pretty much everything so far. I mean, you and I did an article last week. We put together a list of 11 promises that have been quite Brexit promises that have been quietly dropped over the past 18 months or so. Has it been all one-way traffic?
Yeah, mostly in the wrong direction, I think. I think it's interesting listening to Jennifer talk about the sense of things having gone better than expected from the Brussels perspective. It's certainly true that things have gone worse than expected from the British perspective. Not even the most gloomy leaver, Romaniac, as I believe called, could have predicted the negotiations could have gone quite so badly from the British perspective. I mean, every single one of the red lines, the negotiating starting positions has had to shift to some or great extent. I think the most telling thing is there was an awful lot of pomp and circumstance around the 1 year to go anniversary last week. But actually, what really has just happened is that the departure has been put back 2 years. I mean, we have this sort of semantic conversation about whether it's a transition or an implementation phase. Actually, it's a standstill phase. Everything has been put back 2 years, apart from the only things that will happen, anything that will change in a year's time when we leave, is we will lose our MEPs, we'll lose our commissioner, we'll lose our seat on the ECJ, and we will lose any remaining legal protection that comes from being a member state when we negotiate the really tricky stuff to come on trade. So and all the other stuff all of the supposed upsides of leaving are more confused than ever. We don't have any sense now, really, of what the end state looks like, even though it was illusory when after the referendum. I think people could, on both sides of the argument, Remain or Leave, could fairly confidently predict what they thought was going to happen. But now I think the fog really has descended over the Channel. I mean, I think that the if you had to ask me to guess what the country was going to look like in 5 years' time, I'd be a lot harder than I would have done a year ago. And I think the fog will be there for at least 3 years now. That's the other thing.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, well, let's try and pin down some you know, actual things that we can be sure of. Jennifer, in purely practical terms, looking ahead then for the coming 12 months, what's the timetable now as far as the 27 is concerned? What needs to be sorted out between now and June, which is the next summit? And then obviously the one after that, October, which is, we're told, is the deadline for getting the withdrawal agreement properly done and dusted.
Yes, you're right to highlight those summit dates, and that seems to be the pattern that Brexit has settled into now, that there's a period of negotiations between the British and the EU team, and then there's a build up to various summits where EU leaders will sort of mark the report cards, and then the talks move on to the next stage. So as you say, the next moment will be in June, which could be quite a crucial moment for the Irish border issue. Certainly the Irish government wants to see that issue really nailed down. And we've already seen that the UK side has agreed on the so-called backstop, that the Northern Ireland would remain aligned to EU customs and some single market rules in the event of no better solution, which nobody has any much idea of at the moment. So the Irish would really like to see more progress on that in June, and I think they're backed by some other countries as well who don't want to leave this issue to the last minute, and the last minute potentially being October, which is the deadline that Michel Barnier has always penciled in as the moment when he wants to get the Brexit withdrawal treaty finally agreed, and the summit for that would be in mid-October. So that would be the moment for EU leaders to sign that off.
And just remind us why it's so important that it is signed off by October.
Well, in theory, that's to allow for the European Parliament to ratify the deal before March the 29th, 2019. I mean, I say in theory, of course, the European Parliament does have to give its consent to the Brexit withdrawal agreement, and that's an important step that can't be ignored. It does seem to me that 6 months is rather on the long side to do that, albeit that there are various committees that will have to scrutinise the text. But I do wonder if the EU negotiators are building themselves in a little bit of slack in case a bit more time is needed. And there's also the potential, perhaps, for the Article 50 process to be extended by a few weeks if all 28 countries involved in agree. So you could say that's a big ask, but I think it's still at the back of people's minds that it's a possibility. But the really hard deadline will be in May 2019, when there will be European elections. And I think for the EU side, they really want Brexit to be complete by that moment. So that would be the final moment. So if the timetable does slip in October, I think that's not an impossibility. And there is a bit of room and flexibility in that timetable. But I think we shouldn't expect any long drawn out extension.
6 weeks max or so, really.
Yes.
Because you couldn't afford. Okay. Well, so Dan, obviously those dates that Jennifer was talking about will clearly be important ones in the British government's diary too, but there are some important domestic ones, aren't there, as well, particularly some potentially kind of quite crunch votes in the Lords and the Commons. Could you just talk us briefly through from the sort of UK perspective, what the government needs to get through in terms of legislation and whether it'll manage it? I mean, what is the strength of political resistance now to the government's vision for Brexit, such as it is?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I'll deal first with the mountain of legislation that's got to come through between now and next March. There are 11 bills in total. our colleague Jill Rutter, who's a regular on this show from the Institute of Government, has a very handy little chart of all the different bills and where they are in the long process of getting them through Parliament. And what's most striking about it, as anybody who was actually in the room with me rather than listening to me describe it would see, is the big white space.
Okay, yes, yeah. Because
although some of the bills, so for example, the EU withdrawal bill, which is the one that started off the Article 50 process, is the one that gave the government, after they lost the court case, the government had to bring in legislation to invoke Article 50. And that is the sort of most progressed in that it's currently, according to Jill's chart, in the committee stage of the Lords. But almost all the others have still got quite a long way to go. Some of them we haven't even seen so much as a white paper on yet. The migration bill is the one that is particularly interesting. If you remember, we had a leak of an early draft of this a few months back, courtesy of our colleagues Alan Travis and Nick Hopkins, and since then you've seen absolutely hide nor hair of it in Westminster, I think, because it is seen as such a particularly controversial piece of legislation. So that's not even let alone been introduced into the Parliament. We don't even know what it's going to look like. The same goes for the Fisheries Bill, which is a sort of big blank hole at the moment. The Trade Bill is a really interesting one where there are a number of amendments kicking around to require us to stay inside a customs union. Remember, this is a now official Labour Party policy as well, so there's a potential alignment there of Labour and some Tory rebels that could bring down that legislation if the customs amendment isn't accepted. So that's been postponed. We were told it was meant to be heading back before Easter, and now it's been postponed until we think possibly May. So all of this is backing up, basically. And then there's the big one, which is the I'll read out its full title, which is the Withdrawal Agreement and Implementation Bill. This is the, again, government's forced into making this binding primary legislation by the Dominic Grieve rebellion before Christmas. But this basically forces the government to take its result of its negotiations with Brussels and bring it back to Parliament and have an up and down vote on whether to accept the withdrawal agreement that's been negotiated. And that is expected to be in parallel with the European Parliament process that Jennifer's just been describing. So that will be October, November, possibly December, January, depending on
how much slippage there is.
Then to come to your final question, which is like, what is the state of political opposition to this or obstacles to this? That is the currently where we're at, I think, in British politics, which is deciding what happens if that bill does not get voted through, because there is a growing groundswell of voices, not in the leadership of either party, I hasten to add, but in the gaps, the big gap between these two polar opposites, saying that, well, we should have an option of not doing it. If Parliament decides this deal sucks, there should be an opportunity to say, to have a rethink, whether that's through renegotiation, or which is the sort of official Labour Party position, or whether that should be through throwing it back to the country in a general election or referendum, which is the anti-Brexit point of view. We just don't know yet. But that's where we've got to, really, which is if we can get these 10 pieces of legislation through. In the next 4 to 9 months, then we come to a big showdown in the autumn over the final one, which is the withdrawal bill, the withdrawal agreement and implementation bill, sorry. And then the question is, if that doesn't go through, what next?
Yeah. And with the withdrawal bill, of course, crucially, has to contain an element describing what the end state roughly will look like. That's really, I suppose, is going to be one of the big nubs of the whole debate over the coming months. Jennifer, looking at those actual issues that might affect what happens in the year ahead, you wrote about how Brexit had brought the EU together around a sort of a very clear idea of what kind of Brexit should be on offer, the sort of the end state, the future relationship. I was particularly struck by a phrase from one of the people you interviewed who talked about the political price of a soft Brexit was a lot higher than the economic price of a hard Brexit, which I thought was a very neat way of summing up the EU's position. So, I mean, in brief, is that the kind of Brexit that the EU is heading for? And with the other problems that the bloc is facing, because, you know, Brexit is really, in many senses, sort of on the back burner for the EU, can that unity around that core idea of what Brexit should look like, can that be maintained?
Yes, that is a key question, I think. And the quote you mentioned is from Luc van Middelaar, who is a Dutch historian and political theorist. And he's particularly interesting because he worked for a former European Council president, the first European permanent Council president, Herman Van Rompuy. So he had a sort of a seat at the table, if you like, during the years of the Greek debt crisis. Very much saw how this EU instinct for self-preservation kicked in, because during those years when Grexit was the main issue rather than Brexit, there was often this idea that Greece was going to be ejected from the single currency, that it was too much for the other countries to keep it inside. But at the end of the day, there was always this. Certainly a sense, or the lesson people have drawn from that episode is that people underestimated the capacity and the willingness of the EU to maintain its unity.
Right.
And perhaps that's a lesson that's worth bearing in mind when we think about Brexit. And I think the point that he was making that was particularly interesting was that it's easier for the EU to agree on a hard Brexit. And there's a sense to that, because I think if Theresa May turned around tomorrow and said, well, actually, we'd like to stay in a form of customs union, can we work that out? Then that's a lot harder than the UK leaving the customs union. And equally, I think that's why the EU has been so attached to these particular models and structures and doesn't want to depart from them. I mean, of course, the Norway model or the Switzerland model or an FTA Canada model, because it's very hard to come up with something new, because as soon as you do and you start drawing the boundaries in a different way, then if you're offering something special to a country outside, then what's the incentive for those who are paying the EU budget and following the rules inside? So I think as I was saying before, that's helping to shape unity, but it's an interesting question whether you can maintain that given all the other issues that are testing EU unity at the moment. We're seeing very different views on how to reform the Eurozone between France and Germany, but then also between Northern Europe and Southern Europe. We're seeing poisonous debates about the rule of law in Poland and Hungary, and that's an issue that's really testing the EU to the core. What do you do if member states seem to have a while remaining in the EU sort of exit from the core values and the rules? But what's been interesting so far when we just look at Brexit is that none of these issues have really impinged on Brexit, which has so far been put in this special bureaucratic box, and everyone's managed to sort of keep it as a separate issue that doesn't actually there haven't been any spillover effects from those other difficult issues. And I think that's likely to be maintained in the future, and although it depends on the ambition and the scope of the future trading agreement. And that's already a discussion in Brussels. Do you want to have a very sort of detailed vision of that trading agreement for agreed in October, or do you want something a bit more bare bones, a bit less details, which of course is easier for the EU27 to agree on. So yeah. I think there's some sense that we might end up with something rather less decorative than a Christmas tree. That seems to be the okay. metaphor of choice at the moment. Let's not have a Christmas tree.
All right, Dan. Yeah. Well, okay. So I mean, if the EU has basically kind of coalesced around the idea of a harder Brexit because it's easier, you know, the British government. Is still no closer, really, is it, to defining exactly what it wants, or at least I suppose maybe not so much what it wants, but what it can realistically expect to get. But at the same time, the clamour from business for clarity is getting steadily louder. People do seem to be realising that without, you know, a great deal more certainty on what that future relationship will look like, then the transition period is really just kind of postponing that regulatory cliff edge that everybody is so terrified of. How do you see the coming months panning out politically? I mean, is it going to be possible for Theresa May to keep fudging things for as long as she can? I mean, possibly even up to March the 29th?
Well, the worrying thing is there's a sort of alignment of interests to keep this fudge as vague as possible, because not only is it in the government's interest not to really fess up to how awful this deal looks until it's too late to do anything about it, but it's now the official opposition's official policy to kind of collude in the can-kicking exercise. Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, sort of let slip last week what I think is the leadership view in the Labour Party, which is that there'll be a blah-blah-blah deal, she said, on the table.
Which is precisely what Jennifer was just talking about. Yeah.
It won't say very much in detail about what's to come, but it'll be sufficiently vague to allow everybody to read into it what they want. And she used that phrase, blah-blah-blah, as an excuse for saying, well, Labour would be prepared to vote for it. Because it would be sufficiently plastic and malleable to allow them to say that it passed Labour's tests on a Jobs First Brexit and various other woolly.
That's quite a dangerous stance to take.
It was breathtaking, and there was a fierce backlash, and Keir Starmer tried to kind of water it down a little bit, but I think it was a very honest moment from the Labour front bench, which was basically they want out too. The leadership does not want Brexit to be derailed, and much like the ultra-Brexiteers, the reason they think that's okay is they think that once we're past the finish line, once we're out, they can impinge their own view of it that they can make of Brexit what they want. So much as the ultra-Brexiteers, I think, don't imagine Theresa May will stick around much after March 2019, and therefore they can then shape things. Clearly, Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour leadership want to be in power.
Basically is that after 29th of March 2019, Brexit sort of comes up for grabs in a sense that it isn't really at the moment.
Oh, exactly. Well, in the sense that eventually it's going to have to decide what we want.
Yeah.
But the point, the other crucial thing is after March 2019, there is no turning back. Mm. I mean, I think that although many people, again, both party leaderships argue that there hasn't been any turning back since the referendum, in practice, there is quite a lot of the questioning all the time. You know, could we change our minds? Should we have a second referendum? Blah, blah, blah. All these, I'm using blah, blah, blah. It's infectious. But after March 2019, there is no legal political vision for
reverse
returning.
Gear.
No,
yeah.
I mean, maybe in 30 years' time, we might kind of. So that's why I think there is this collusion in getting us over that point without really fessing up to what it means.
Right. I mean, Jennifer, just briefly, actually, we're running out of time a little bit. Is the EU prepared for that eventuality? Do you think that's what Europe is sort of half expecting to happen?
I think everyone's working on the assumption that Brexit will happen on the 29th of March 2019 and that there will be no turning back from the UK. And it would be actually a shock and probably a difficult thing for the EU to decide exactly what to do if the UK did change its mind. I mean, I'm sure that the UK would remain a member, but there would certainly be a debate about on what terms and whether you could guarantee that there wasn't going to be another referendum that maybe produced a narrow result in the other way, a sort of 52-48 remain, which could be just as politically difficult for the UK and the EU. But yes, it is preparing for all eventualities in terms of, if you look up the advice it's sending out to industry groups, it's still telling people that Brexit will happen on the 29th of March 2019, and there's a not too subtle reminder here that yes, there's a transition, but it's only a transition on paper, and that, back to our favourite phrase, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And that's certainly the line that the EU likes to keep reminding the UK, that there's still more to be done before it's all nailed down in October.
Dan, just very briefly, finally, a lot of the chat last week was about the possibility of a second referendum. What's the balance of probabilities and outcomes, do you think, there between this question of a sort of a meaningful vote on the final deal and a possible public say?
Well, I was more optimistic a few weeks ago because I think the penny was beginning to drop in terms of how much betrayal there was from Leavers and Remainers. I think why I'm a bit more gloomy in the last couple of weeks has been what I just alluded to in this intransigence on the Labour leadership, because any scenario that gets us to a second referendum or more ideally a general election requires a shift in position from Corbyn on this. And if anything, we've seen a digging in of the heels in the last couple of weeks. So without a shift there, the latest today is talk of David Miliband coming back, the Prince Across the Water, the return of the centrist hero. But that's a really long term game. I mean, the reinvention of the political centre is not going to happen between now and March 2019. If this is just about Brexit rather than a much bigger thing, and I think it's a much bigger thing, but if it was just about Brexit, the only path to changing the country's course goes through Corbyn. And right now, he's pretty adamantly against.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so, yes, I mean, it does sound like about the only thing we can be absolutely sure of then is that the coming year is not going to be short of developments. And on that note, we'll call it a day. That's it for this week. My thanks to Dan and Jennifer once again for joining me today. Please do subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. If you want to get in touch, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. We'll be taking a brief break next week. We'll be back on Wednesday, the 18th of April. Till then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.